Hello, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming to the last session of the day. Let me just briefly introduce the organization I work for called SurfNet. We are the national research network in the Netherlands, which means that we provide internet connectivity to universities, research institutions, and teaching hospitals. Now, for some of you who are wondering, this is a question I get often, why are we called SurfNet? It's not because of surfing the web, because we were founded in 1986, before the web even existed. SURF is actually an acronym in Dutch, which is something like collaborating university research, computer centers, something like that. We run a fiber optic network in the Netherlands. We have some 10,500 kilometers of fibers, which, if you think that the Netherlands is about the size of the state of New York, is quite an impressive amount of fiber. And we also do ICT innovation for our connected institutions, which means that we try to find out what the new things are and come up with cool ICT solutions that they can use in their teaching and research. We have over 160 connected institutions with some million end users, which includes students, staff, and researchers. Now, we cooperate internationally within Terrena, which is the European Foundation of Research Networks, also with Internet 2 here in the States. They provide the connectivity to all the major universities here, and with the folks from NLNet Labs and RIPE NCC. And RIPE NCC is the equivalent of ERIN, but then in Europe and the Middle East. Now, a brief overview of what I'm going to talk to you about today. I'm just going to introduce DNSSEC to you quickly. I know that some of you will have attended Alan Clegg's tutorial on Sunday on DNSSEC, so I'm not going to dive into the details there, but rather I would like to point you to his teaching material. What I'm going to talk to you about is the real-life experience that we have had with DNSSEC since we've been rolling it out. I'm going to concentrate first on resolving, talk to you about that, then operating science zones, then a lot of information on the lessons we learned, the mistakes that we and others have made, and what happens if you make mistakes with DNSSEC, a little bit about monitoring, and then some advice to you on what you've got to do if you want to roll out DNSSEC. Now, let's give a quick reminder of what we need DNS for. I don't know if you have TomTom in the States. It's a SatNav system. And you could say that DNS is like the TomTom of the internet. You tell it where you want to go, and it gives you an IP address. And that works quite well. It's been doing that since the mid-80s, quite reliably. It's quick, a lot of redundancy in the network. And for instance, if I want to go to my bank in this case, I ask the DNS, okay, what is the IP address for my bank? How do we need to get there? And it points me in the right direction. Unfortunately, DNS is under attack. And why would you want to attack DNS? Well, there are various reasons for that. DNS is everywhere, right? It's not just on your laptops or in your desktop computer, but it's also in your phone, it's in your car, it's in an ATM. I even found DNS in an elevator somewhere. My parents live in an apartment building. And I flipped open my laptop, and without noticing, I had internet connectivity. And I'm so used to having internet connectivity that wasn't strange to me until I found out that the network I was on was called Otis Remote Servicing. So I was actually piggybacking on the internet connection of the elevator in the building that they used to check whether the elevator was working and probably to talk to people if they're caught out in an elevator that's stuck. Now, what I'm going to tell you about is that plain DNS is very hard to protect against attacks. And I'm going to illustrate that with this diagram here. What this shows you from left to right is the complete DNS server infrastructure. On the left-hand side, you have your stub resolver, which is a thing that sits on your end-user system. Basically, a stub resolver is a stupid piece of software. The only thing it can do is ask a question to a more intelligent piece of software, which is called a caching resolver. Now, that is, if you get a DHCP list from like your ISP, it also includes the DNS server, and that is the caching resolver in this diagram. Now, this caching resolver in itself will go out onto the internet if you ask it a question, and it will try to find the answer for you. And to do that, it queries what are called authoritative servers, which are, in the middle of the diagram, the primary and secondary name servers for domains. And up until a couple of years ago, that was all working fine, and there were some attacks that were known, but they were on a meh level. No real problems, right? There was something called cache poisoning, but nobody bothered to protect against that because it was just something that didn't really matter. Until in 2008, Dan Kaminsky came along. He introduced a new cache poisoning attack, which was much worse than anything that was known before. And what the bottom line is that if you perform his attack, you can basically take over an entire domain and point people to your name servers instead of to the real name servers if you're the attacker. And that means that, for instance, if I go back to the bank example, I can get people to come to my phishing site without them noticing. They'll just type in the web address of their bank, and they will end up on my site, which looks really like their bank website, only it logs their passwords and stuff like that. And we know that this attack has been taking place. There are examples, for instance, a large ISP in Brazil was attacked last year in April, and they had poisoned their DNS cache and inserted a bogus record for a big bank in Brazil, and users were being redirected to the wrong site. And stuff like SSL doesn't protect you against this. Because I don't know what your experience is, but my experience is that it is very easy to get an SSL certificate from people like, I don't know, GoDaddy or VeriSign. I just paid them $100 and I get an SSL certificate and it just says what I wanted to say. Now I redirect people, instead I poison their DNS cache, redirect them to my servers. They will get a little padlock sign and they think it's secure, it's got an SSL certificate, but they will be on my site and not on their bank site. So that was bad news, right? This DNS was vulnerable, you couldn't trust it anymore, and how could you know you ended up on the right site? There was a big fuss about this in 2008. People started patching their servers, they started integrating some controls to stop the attack from going because you could add some randomness to DNS queries, would improve your situation, but it didn't really solve the problem. It just made it harder for attackers to get to your cache and poison it, but it didn't stop them from doing it. In fact, research that was done by people from the Czech top-level registry and a guy in Russia who worked there as a physicist showed that even if you patch your servers against the Kaminsky attack, you can still succeed if you go full-blown within 11 hours in attacking a resolver. And some other research showed that it's even worse, right? If there's a full 1 gigabit link going into your server and it's flooded with spoofed packets, you'll notice that, right? That's a spike in your traffic. But the guy who develops PowerDNS, are there any PowerDNS users here in the room? It's an authoritative DNS server. It's popular in Europe, but I guess not in the States. He did some research, and he found out is that if you send only a couple of spoofed packets to the server at a time, in such a way that you won't notice it if you do traffic monitoring, then it will take you about 6 weeks to perform an attack on a resolver, and within 6 weeks, you have a 50% chance of succeeding. Now remember, the bad guy, he has all the time in the world. Once he has succeeded, he will put a spoofed record in there that has a time to live of forever, and he's in. He can attack your users. Now, if you briefly go back, the attacks take place on the caching resolver, right? That's the thing that sits in your ISP. So once I've attacked that, I've effectively redirected traffic for hundreds of thousands of users, and not just one home user. Now there is good news. DNSSEC has been around for a long time, and this actually solves this Kaminsky attack. So what is DNSSEC? Well, DNSSEC has been around for a long time. It was first introduced in 1997 when the first cache poisoning attacks became known. And we are already at the third generation of the protocol. The first DNSSEC protocol was finalized in 2000, but people really didn't start rolling it out because there was little use for it at the time. And then people started having a look at it and seeing what the operational implications of the protocol were, and they found out that the first version of the protocol was actually pretty unusable for real-life deployment. So they went back to the drawing board, and the guys at the IETF sat down and came up with what's called DNSSEC BIS, which came out in 2005. Now, that is the version of the protocol that we have today, with a few additions. But that didn't start rolling out until 2008 when Kaminsky came along. And suddenly everybody realized, hey, this DNSSEC thing is something we've got to do. They made a brief addition to the protocol in 2008, which was to add what is called NSEC3. This has to do with authenticated denial of existence. Look it up on the internet. I'm not going to go into detail about that. Now, DNSSEC is quite complicated. There are over 20 active RFCs involved, and you really don't want to have to read all of them, because that's a pain. I read all of them, and it just gives you headaches. But the protocol is mature. That the only changes that are taking place at the moment is adding of new algorithms, like the GOST algorithm, which is a Russian algorithm, and like support for elliptic curve cryptography. Now, DNSSEC works based on public key cryptography. It adds digital signatures to the DNS. So a digital signature is like a wax seal, right? It proves that the answer that comes from the DNS can be trusted. And resolvers validate these signatures that are set on the DNS records. So what DNSSEC does, it proves the authenticity of the data you get back when you send a query out to the DNS. What it doesn't do is add stuff like confidentiality, right? If you visit www.hotladies.com, people can still see you making that query rather than DNSSEC protecting you against this. It doesn't protect you against denial of service attacks. Far from it, it makes it worse because DNS packets become quite a bit larger if you start doing DNSSEC. And it doesn't stop people from typo squatting or phishing or whatever. Now, the deployment status of DNSSEC has been going quite well in the last 2 years. The root zone was signed this year on July 15th, for those of you who managed to miss that. It was a big event. There was lots of publicity around it. And it was, to many people in the DNS community, quite a surprise that they managed to get around to doing this, because there's a lot of politics involved there. Lots of top-level domains and country code top-level domains have been signed in the last few years, starting with people like .gov, who had a mandate. They had to do it. But also people like .org who said, okay, we want to be the first people to have a TLD that is properly signed and it's open to everyone. And of course VeriSign has now come along, and they've stated that they're going to sign .net before the end of this year, and .com is going to start in March 2011. And of course many countries across the world have gone out and signed their TLDs as well. Now, normally, if you register a domain in the DNS, you don't go directly to a top-level registry, but instead you go through what is called a registrar. And in order for DNSSEC to be rolled out all the way to your second-level domain, you need the cooperation of your registrar. And the good news is that registrars are now starting to support DNSSEC. And some big names like GoDaddy and Name.com have DNSSEC support. And not only for .org, but also for domains like .us, .info, etc. So for the first time, it is now possible to actually register DNSSEC signed domains. We run both resolvers that do validation, as well as we sign domains. And what I do is I monitor the validation rate that we get on our resolvers. And what this graph shows is the validation rate starting from week 25. The x-axis at the bottom of the graph is the week number in this year, and on the y-axis it's the percentage of queries that we got, the sort of total number of queries that we got that we could validate. And what you can see is in around week 28 the root got signed, and you can see a big spike there. So there's a jump. Once the root got signed, we got lots of validatable queries back. And there's also a bit of a strange spike that I'll tell you a little bit about later in the presentation. But what it shows you that now the validation rate is above 2%, which means that one in 50 queries that I get on my resolvers can be validated, which is actually quite good. For instance, if you compare this to the IPv6 traffic on our network, on the outgoing links, that is below 1%. So DNSSEC is doing better than IPv6 in deployment. And once again, my colleagues are going to hate me for saying this. Now, operating a validating resolver is the next topic. Are there any people in the room here already operate the validating resolver? Yeah, a couple of hands going up, four people. That's good. Five, sorry, Alan. Well, it turns out that operating a validating resolver isn't that hard. All of the major DNS software that is out there supports validation, right? Bind does it, Unbound does it, Microsoft DNS supports it, Simple DNS Plus, the commercial products, Nominum support it. And there are a couple of exceptions, like DJB DNS by Dan Bernstein, who is a fervent hater of DNSSEC, so that's the reason he doesn't support it. And what you can also see in this table on the right-hand side is whether or not they support what is called RFC 5011. Now, the reason why you want to support that thing called RFC 5011 is because it has got to do with trust anchor configuration. If you want to be able to validate the answer you got to a query, you need to start with trust somewhere, right? If you have SSL in your browser, you have these root certificates. And whenever you get a certificate back from a website and you want to check its authenticity, you go all the way up into it until you reach its root certificate. And if you can trust the whole chain from the root certificate down, that means you can trust the certificate. Well, the same is true for DNSSEC. Only DNSSEC has a single root, which is the root of the DNS system, which is now signed. But you need to configure this trust anchor for the DNS root. And actually, the trust anchor for the DNS root is shown here on the slide. And it's very important that before you configure this, that you check the validity of this trust anchor, because you're investing a lot of trust in this. If someone can trick you into putting a different trust anchor in there, I can take over the whole DNS and you won't notice. You'll think it's completely trusted. So before you configure a trust anchor, you need to validate it. That's why I put it up on the slide. If you think I'm a trustworthy guy, you can just see if it looks like this. The trouble with trust anchors is that DNSSEC involves changing your keys every once in a while. You have two keys in DNSSEC, actually. You have what is called a key signing key and a zone signing key, usually. And the key signing key will roll typically every year or maybe every 2 years. So that would mean that you would need to change the trust anchor in your configuration once that key is rolled. Now, RFC 5011 is very important here because that allows you to automatically track rollovers. So if, for instance, the root decides that, hey, it's time to set up a new KSK, and they do RFC 5011, which means that your resolver will automatically pick this up, install the new trust anchor, and happily keep on going. Now, how do you set up a validating resolver? Well, I'm not going to talk you through the whole thing, but I have put up two short how-tos that explain you how to do it, one for bind and the other for unbound, and I guess the presentation is going to be available, so don't bother typing the links. And what we do is I want to do a little bit of promotion here. We work together with the guys from Anelnet Labs, and they have written a resolver completely from scratch, which is called Unbound. And all it does is be a caching resolver, right? It doesn't do authoritative DNS. It is dedicated to resolving. And it's got DNSSEC built in from the start. Unlike Bind, which has sort of evolved to include DNSSEC, although they're doing a rewrite for Bind 10, which is going to be built from scratch. And we're very happy about Unbound. The performance on Unbound is very good on our name servers. We saw a performance increase of about four times lower loads and quicker responsiveness on our resolvers when we changed it from the default binds setup that we had. Now, say that you have followed the how-tos and you have set up a validating resolver. How do you check if it's working? Well, that's actually very easy. There are a lot of DNS time domains out there already, and one of them, for instance, is the website for IIS, which is the top-level registry for Sweden. Sweden has been signed for a long time. Alan referred to it as in his presentation. And what you do is you send out a query, ask it for a DNSSEC answer, and query your resolver, and the answer that you get back will show one thing extra. If you look at the flags field that comes back, if DNSSEC is enabled and the signature was validated correctly, then there will be an extra flag set, which is called AD, which means authenticated data. Now, if that is set, then that means your resolver has checked that the signature is on www.riis.se is valid. And the stuff at the bottom is actually the signature on the A record for www.iis.se. There's also another way of checking whether your resolver functions correctly, because you also need to find out if it ignores domains that have signing failures. Well, the guys from the Czech top-level registry have made a nice site. It's the one with the green key. If you go to their website and use only validating resolvers, then the website will show you a green key. If you have a resolver that's not validating, it will show you a red key. And they do this by having a domain name which has a deliberately invalid signature, and that is what gives you back the image for the red key. So if that fails to resolve, you get back the image for the green key. Of course, you could also surf to dnssec-failed.org and definitely try test dnssec-or-not.org, because that is very funny. I won't give it away. Just give it a go. Try it. Now, one of the things that will happen if you enable DNSSEC on your resolvers is that there are going to be validation failures. People make mistakes. They forget to resign their domain. They have network issues. And that will mean that validations will fail. Now, in case a validation fails on your resolver will tell the client that is asking the questions that it has a surf fail. Now, surf fail is a very generic error, right? You can't tell from surf fail what happened on the other end, but that is what will happen. And to end users, it will seem like the domain is offline or the domain doesn't exist anymore. So what happens? Do they call the help desk? Do they tell you, hey, my internet is broken? Well, in our experience, that doesn't happen. We turned on DNSSEC validation on our resolvers somewhere at the beginning of last year, and we have had zero help desk calls of people not being able to resolve certain domains. And I will tell you, there have been a lot of problems. Especially in the .gov domain, they had to rush into signing their domains, and they made a lot of mistakes. And one of them was the US Patent Office, USPTO. And because we have researchers as users, they query stuff like the US Patent Office quite often. And they weren't able to send email to them, they weren't able to look at their website, etc. Same goes for the National Institutes of Health. They've also made a couple of mistakes, which meant that databases like PubMed were offline. And those are important databases to our users. But they accept that stuff goes wrong, and they haven't called our help desk. Another reason for that is that, of course, many users not only use our resolvers, but they also have resolvers at their local institution. And if a surf fail occurs, then their client will just see if it has any other name servers configured, and it will ask the next one. And if that doesn't do validation, they will still get an answer, albeit with a slight delay in there. Now, what is important, and the XKCD comic shows that, is that if you see validation failures, you will see them in your logs. Try to contact the people that have problems. Try to tell them about it. At least that's what I try to do, because that's the only way that DNSSEC is going to gain wider acceptance on the internet, if you help people that make mistakes. And further on in the presentation, I'm going to show you quite a few mistakes that occurred. Now, one of the things that I get asked often is whether turning on DNSSEC had any impact on our resource usage. Because DNSSEC is all this crypto stuff, right? You need to do RSA or DSA or, in future, elliptic curves. And that is going to eat CPU cycles. Now, we've been running with full validation for going on 2 years now. And actually, the impact on our CPU load has been negligible. We can't tell the difference between the graphs before we turned on validation and after we turned on validation. The graph below shows the load average on one of our resolvers, and as you can see, it doesn't go above 0.4 very often, so that's basically, the CPU is just sitting there doing nothing, and this is a very busy resolver that handles thousands of queries per second. So DNSSEC turning that on didn't have that big an impact. So what I would say is, it will probably work on your existing infrastructure. And remember, if you have a big DNS resolver farm, you probably want to have more than one resolver. And you want to load balance them rather than having one big one that handles all the queries. Because in that case, the bottleneck is going to be the network pipe that goes into it. So if you see that the load becomes unacceptable, simply add another server to it. But don't bother to buy special hardware for your resolver, because it will run just fine with the existing hardware that you have. Now remember the spike in the validation rate that I showed you. I run a blog about our DNSSEC deployment. I'll show the link at the end of the presentation. And I asked the readers whether they could help me. They told them, you can win a pie if you can tell me how this spike came along. And it took a couple of days, but someone came up with the right answer. Here he is, it's Hugo from Chile. Unfortunately, there were no online pie shops in Chile, so I couldn't send him one. But the next time he's over in Europe, I'm going to buy him a pie and a beer, probably. And what he came up with is that the spike is just after the root got signed. Right? If you look at the graph, the root got signed in week 28, and then the spike occurs just a couple of weeks later. Well, what happened is, when the root got signed, top-level domains started putting secure delegations in the root zone. And they did this gradually. And because we were not just using the root trust anchor, but we were also using something that is called DLV, which is DNSSEC look-aside validation, which is a service by ISC where you can get trust anchors from their repository, some domains were validated through both lines, and they counted double in our statistics. So that explains the spike. Now, one of the things you're going to run into if you turn on DNSSEC is that you're probably going to have to do some troubleshooting. Now, why is this? As I already mentioned, DNSSEC has much larger packet sizes. That is because the digital signatures are in the answers, DNSSEC also relies on what is called eDNS0, which is an extension to DNS that has been around for about 10 years. And one of the things in there is the DO bit, which is the DNSSEC OK bit, which you need if you want to ask an authoritative server for DNSSEC answers. Unfortunately, lots of network hardware thinks that DNS is only UDP and it's only 512 bytes. And it is surprising the amount of network hardware that thinks that this is true. Firewalls, small office routers, older router equipment, say older than 5 years, that thinks this. Security auditor firms which tell you to disable TCP on DNS because it's just not safe. You just close that hole in your network. Whereas DNS, of course, is UDP and TCP and has been for years. Fragmented UDP packets. I had a serious problem with my Red Hat Enterprise Linux IP tables firewall. IPv4 worked fine, but because we try to do the security on two levels, right? We have an ACL on the network equipment, but we also try to have a host-based firewall. And since we are a research network, we obviously run both V4 and V6. And it turned out that if you turn on the IPv6 tables in Red Hat, that will seriously break your IPv6 implementation because the MTU drops to the lowest possible MTU on V6, which is 1280 bytes, which means that DNSSEC answers now have to be fragmented. And then the firewall decided that, hey, these fragmented packets, I probably can't trust them. You know what? The first fragment I'll accept and the rest I'll throw away. Which meant that we saw heaps of validation failures because our resolvers were unable to get correct answers back from the authoritative servers. So really, you should watch your network hardware when you turn on DNSSEC. And this is, of course, also true if you start signing your zones and start serving out signed answers, because the people that are talking to you also have to go through your firewall, which is, again, discarding these packets that are larger than 512 bytes, etc. Now, that's all about operating a validating resolver. So how about operating a signed zone? Are there any people in the room here who operate signed zones? One, two, three. Anyone who does that and it's not for a hobby? One, two, three. Okay, that's good. So why do you sign your zone? Well, there are several reasons for that. One of the reasons could be that you have a website that represents a certain value, like an e-commerce website or a banking website or whatever, and you want people to be able to trust that the answer they get back from DNS is whatever you put in your zone. It could also be to protect your organization against redirection of other internet traffic. If I can poison caches, that means I can redirect anything that uses DNS, and that will include stuff like voice over IP or email or whatever you can think of. Right? The whole internet relies on DNS. It could be to protect your users. You don't want them to go to spoofed sites. Another reason could be that you want to leverage the trust that DNSSEC can establish. Once you have DNSSEC, you can use it that as a basis to bootstrap other trust. You no longer have to rely on guys like VeriSign and Komodo to get certificates. You can just use a self-signed certificate, put the certificate in the DNS, and use the DNSSEC trust to bootstrap the trust in the certificate. You can store SSH fingerprints for all your servers in DNS. And no longer have your client ask you, do you want to trust this new server that you're logging into? You can just rely on what's in DNS. And another good reason is because your competitor does it. And I gave a talk last week at the Dutch top-level registry about DNSSEC. And the registrars there are now starting to get warmed up about DNSSEC because, hey, they see that people have an interest in this. And it's a competitive edge to be able to say, we can do DNSSEC, we can secure your domain. So that could be a good reason to do it. Now, of course, we are not a commercial organization. We run a research network. So we did a study among our users and asked them, are you interested in DNSSEC? Are you going to do anything with it? And we did that this summer as part of our deployment project. And we asked about 170 people, how do you feel about DNSSEC? Well, the first surprise we got was that we got 40 responses, which is quite a lot. If you think that most surveys that we send out, we probably get maybe 10 or 20 people answering, and because that is the 10th survey that they got that month and they're not interested, well, we got quite a big response. And another surprise is that two-thirds of users felt that DNSSEC is important. They know about it. They feel that they need to do something with this. And as you can see in the graph on the left, we asked people to rate the importance of DNSSEC on a scale from 1 to 10. And the people that said 7 said, well, we think it might be important, but we're not at risk from cache poisoning attacks. Everybody above 8, we asked them to type a little comment why they gave that ranking to it. And all of them said, we think we need to protect our domains. We think this adds to our security. Now, we asked those people that had an interest whether or not they were planning to sign their domains. And three-quarters of them said, yes, we're going to sign our domains, and we're going to do it soon. Most of them have plans to do it in 2011. And that was quite a surprise to us that they were so interested in doing that. Now, one thing important to consider is, when do you start signing your zone? Well, as I mentioned before, your infrastructure needs to be ready, right? If you still have old firewall equipment and stuff that you aren't quite sure how it works, or your DNS servers are old, you may want to invest in upgrading that first and get that going in the right direction. You should have a clear mandate from your management. That sounds a bit obvious, but it is really important, because if you make a mistake and if you break things, then the impact could be that your domain disappears off the internet, at least for people that do validation. And for top-level domains, it's even more horrible. Even if your domain, your second-level domain isn't signed, but your top-level domain is, and they make a mistake and people validate, then you are offline as well. So you should really have a clear mandate, because it affects everything on your network. I'll tell you a little bit about a mistake that we made and a problem that we had that caused all my colleagues to be unable to read their email, people to be unable to log into websites because our identity federation wasn't working, and that had an impact on our 1 million end users. So that is quite bad. So think before you act. And, of course, the way back, once you've said, okay, we are going to sign our domains, you can now trust us, the way back is much harder. Because if you remove this trust, then what are you telling your users that are resolving your domain? So you need to think about this. Now, we did a DNSSEC deployment, signing deployment this year, both for ourselves as well as for our users. And I'm going to talk to you about that a little bit to illustrate the kind of decisions we had to make in order to get there. We run a managed DNS environment that is called Servdomeinen. That's Dutch. Some of the screenshots are going to be in Dutch, but that's not going to have any impact on my talk. Which allows our users to register domains, but it also allows them to operate zones, right? They don't have to have their own DNS infrastructure. Instead, they can use our system, edit their zones, and it will be served out on our authoritative name servers. Now, of course, many institutions run their own infrastructure, but some of the smaller ones rely on us for this. And our goal was to make it easy for them to enable DNSSEC. It should be like a box to tick, rather than having to think about all these policy decisions that DNSSEC involves. And what we did is we enabled DNSSEC for our own domain, servnet.nl, at the end of September. This is a screenshot of what our managed DNS environment looks like. I'm sure it will look familiar to quite a few of you. Some of you will have this. Anybody here operate something like this for their users, their constituency? One? Only one, that's a surprise, okay. Anybody here have an IPAM system, IP address management system? One, two. They have interfaces that look like this as well, and some of them integrate DNSSEC support. What this shows you is on the left-hand side a screen that users can rely on to edit their zones. Now, the first thing we did when we started our project was to set out the requirements. As I said, DNSSEC should be a box to tick. It should be easy to deploy DNSSEC for our users rather than having to make all these policy decisions, rolling out software, etc. The integrity of zones should be guaranteed. Now, what does that mean? If you enable DNSSEC, you are signing the data that is in the zone. But that means you need to make sure that the data you put in the zone is something you can trust. Now, we have a web portal where people can edit their zones. So is that going to be the weakest link? If they hack that, then a signature is going to be put on that. So that was a big requirement. The web portal system shouldn't become the weakest link when we start signing domains. Monitoring. We also felt right at the start of the project that we should invest a lot in monitoring, because, as I said, if you make mistakes, your domain could go offline, etc. So we invested quite a bit in that, and I'll tell you a little bit about that later. If you enable DNSSEC, it shouldn't take too long. People shouldn't have to wait for days before their domain is signed. And finally, once it's enabled, users shouldn't notice that it's there. If they edit their zone now, then our system will push out the changes that they made within 5 minutes. And if they have DNSSEC enabled, it should still happen within 5 minutes. It shouldn't take longer to make changes to their domains. Now I'm going to talk you through some of the design decisions that we made. And the first design decision is that we said we are going to use what is called a hardware security module. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, hands up, who doesn't know what a HSM is? Good, everybody knows. Wow. So, a secure and robust way to store key material, but the most important thing is we can never access the raw key material. And because we are managing domains on behalf of our users, we want to be able to tell them, hey, your domain is safe with us. We cannot access your keys. We cannot do bad things on your behalf. People who hack our system still cannot get at your key material. It also allows us some form of role separation, right? We have security officers who can make backups of the HSM but can't access key material, etc., stuff like that. And they are equipped with a standard API, which means that they integrate very well with DNSSEC products like OpenDNSSEC and Bind. The only disadvantage of HSMs is they are very expensive. The box that is shown here on the slide is the one we have, and that's about 20K per unit. So that can be prohibitive if you're a small organization. Now, the next design decision that we made is that we were going to use OpenDNSSEC to sign our domains. The most important reason is that it is a matter of eating our own dog food, right? We participate in the OpenDNSSEC project. By the way, the can be found on opendnsec.org. We work together with the Swedish top-level registry, English top-level registry, Dutch top-level registry, and some consultancy firms. And this is an open-source signer solution. It fully automates DNSSEC for you, and the goal of the project is to come up with push-the-button signing. At the time when this project was started, the only tools that you had were the Bind tools, and although they worked very well, they didn't automate things for you, which meant you had to manually re-sign your zone, you had to think about stuff like key rollovers, which made it hard to deploy DNSSEC. It's been designed to function like a bump in the wire, and I'll show you what I mean by that in a slide. It allows you to have different policies for different customers. So I can, for instance, roll the keys for one customer every month. I can roll keys for another customer every 3 months. I can decide on key sizes, validity time for signatures, stuff like that. And it allows me the possibility to share keys. The HSM that I showed you, the very expensive device, has a limit on the number of objects that you can store on it. And since we operate quite a number of zones, a couple of thousand, we can't have keys, separate keys for every domain. But what we can do is share keys between all the domains for one customer. And OpenDNSSEC allows us to do that. And from a security perspective, there is no reason why you can't share keys between separate domains as long as they belong to one organization, I guess. A little bit more about OpenDNSSEC. We are currently at release 1.1, which is the version that is used by several top-level registries, for instance, in the UK, France, Sweden, the Netherlands, to sign their domains. We use it as well. We are working on 1.2, which is due to be released by the end of this quarter. And that will have a faster signer engine in it. It will have better support for key sharing and another couple of usability improvements. We're also working on version 1.3, and that's going to have a major overhaul of some components to make it even easier to use, because although we say it should be a push-the-button solution, we aren't there yet. You still need to know quite a bit in order to work with OpenDNSSEC. A little bit about the architecture of the system. What you can see here is a diagram of what OpenDNSSEC looks like on the inside. We have something that is called a key and signing policy, and that is what guides how OpenDNSSEC works. That basically talks to something which is called the enforcer, which enforces the policy, and it enforces policies through the signer engine. Now, the bump in the wire aspect is that an input zone goes in on one end, OpenDNSSEC does its magic, and a sign zone comes out the other end. And whenever it is necessary to re-sign a zone or whenever it is necessary to roll a key, then the enforcer will simply tell the signer to do this, and your zone will be signed continuously and correctly. It integrates with HSM using the the XS11 interface. Now this slide shows you the bump in the wire aspect of OpenDNSSEC. On the top of the slide you can see a very common DNS setup, which is that you have a hidden primary system where you edit your zones, where you you make changes, and then you have a public primary system which faces the internet. Right? Your hidden primary can be in a sandbox behind a firewall, and the public primary is what talks to the internet, so that if your public primary gets hacked, you don't have a problem, you just turn off the system, replace it with a new one, and you can still keep going. OpenDNSSEC slots right in between. What you do is you put OpenDNSSEC between your hidden primary and your public primary, and what it will do is it will transfer a DNS zone in, it will sign it, and will transfer it out to your public primary. Now, how does that translate to our setup? Well, this is a diagram of what our setup looks like, and what you see on the top is our serve domaining system, which is our hidden primary, the DNS signer in between, and our public DNS infrastructure on the right-hand side. I hope you can read this, but it doesn't say DNS transfer between serve domain and the signer, it says SCP. So it's not quite a bump in the wire, and there's a reason for that that I'm going to explain to you in a little bit. Let's say that we ran into some problems. What you also need to think about when you set up a DNS signer is network security. As I said, if you start signing your domains, then what then becomes the weakest link? If people can hack the server that you edit your domains on, then what value is there in signing your domain? So we created quite a complex design for our network where we have all these separate VLANs for all the components. And one of the things that we specifically protect is the HSM. We have a networked HSM. And only the signer and system administrators have access to it. But actually, it has two network ports, one that you can use for using the HSM to do signing, and one you can use to do system administration on it. And actually, the HSM use port is only accessible to the signer, and the system administration port is only accessible to sysadmins. So my message would be, think about your network design when you start deploying DNSSEC, because you don't want your network to become the next weakest link. Another important aspect is redundancy. In the past, if you had DNS, then your DNS server would be this box that sat there in the back of the room, quietly humming to itself, and it would serve out queries to the internet. And you had secondary servers, right? If your box failed, no problem. You had secondaries who did the job for you. Well, with DNSSEC, that is still true. But if your signer breaks, you have a problem, because the signatures in DNSSEC have a limited validity. In our case, our signatures are valid for a week. So if our signer breaks and doesn't re-sign the zone within a week, then that means that our domain will go offline because the signatures will become invalid. So you will need to think about redundancy. One of the things you can play with is the re-signing interval. For instance, OpenDNSSEC will re-sign records in your zone sometime before the signature expires. So what we have done is 3 days before the signatures are due to expire, the zone is re-signed. So we always have a 3-day window to fix our signer if it breaks. But we've also added redundancy by having a standby signer. So if the main signer goes down, we can switch to the other one. We have two HSMs in physically separate locations. Most of the Netherlands is below sea level, and our main signer is in Amsterdam, which is several meters below sea level. So if that floods, we still don't have a problem because the other one is about 50 meters above sea level. And we also backup key material in a third location. We have what is called a secure backup token, which we simply slot into our HSM. We give a backup command, and we take it out and put it in a safe somewhere, so that in the event of both locations burning down, we can still restore our infrastructure. Now, all these complicated design issues and all these implementation considerations, they all led to these three dialogues. This is what our users see. They see push the button signing. Although the text is in Dutch, don't bother reading it. It's all about the little shield, right? A zone that is unsigned on the left has a gray shield, which means that DNSSEC is disabled, and they can push a button that says enable DNSSEC. Then the little spinner will start going, and about 15 minutes later, the shield will go blue, and their zone is signed. That's all they have to do. And my advice would be, if you deploy DNSSEC, make it this easy for your users, because otherwise, simply, it is too hard for most people to understand. DNS is complicated as it is. If you add DNSSEC, it just becomes more complicated. Now, monitoring. As I said, at the beginning, we thought we should invest a lot in monitoring, because monitoring is important. It helps you to detect problems early on. And when you monitor a signed zone, you should always look for stuff like signature expiry. As I said, we have a policy where our signatures are valid for a week, but they are re-signed 3 days before they expire. So we have a monitoring system which checks the validity of signatures, and if they are valid for less than 3 days, then something must have gone wrong. And actually, this monitoring helped us, because last week we had an issue with this. The HSMs that we have run in what is called a high availability mode, and because of a network glitch, the HSMs have become out of sync. And because they were out of sync, some key material got generated on one during a key rollover, and it didn't get generated on the other one. And OpenDNSSEC said, hey, I can't find the keys anymore, I can't resign your zone. So we had an issue there. And because we had monitoring, we still had these, well, little less than 3 days, but about 2.5 days to fix the problem. And nobody noticed because we had the monitoring in place. What you also want to do is have a validating resolver that continuously validates some key records in your zone to make sure that if a signature error occurs, you pick it up immediately so you can start working on it. What is probably also good is when you first start deploying DNSSEC, of course you start with a test zone, but what you may also want to do is bring the time to live on your records down a bit so that if something goes wrong, you have and you fix it, it doesn't stay in caches forever. And another important aspect is to monitor from outside your own network. And that is because of the firewall equipment that I mentioned earlier, the router equipment, stuff like host-based firewalls. You want to check that the people that are querying your authoritative servers from the internet get the right answers, so you need to monitor what they are seeing from outside your own network. And there are a lot of tools around there. We had our own tool project, dnssecmonitor.org, which is basically experimental, but it can have a look at it. It may serve as something that you can use. It is a plugin for Nagios that does continuous validation and can also check like things like signature expiry. Another important tool that you can use, DNSVIS by Sandia National Laboratories here in the US, that is very good. That will show you a complete trust chain and will show you where problems are if you have problems. And that is a very good tool if you want to debug your setup. Now, some advice for getting started. The first bit of advice is use the tooling that is available. Don't go into making homegrown solutions. There are good tools out there that are being maintained by an active community. Please use those tools. Make sure you have good monitoring, right? And write down your policies and procedures. Because when something goes wrong, when you need to do something like an emergency key rollover or your HSM breaks, you don't want to have to find out what you have to do when that happens. You need to think about that before it happens. And the thing in the red box is very important. Check with your secondaries for DNSSEC support. Now, why am I saying this? DNSSEC records need to be served out not only by your primary name server, but also by all your secondary name servers. And this is an issue that I've seen. I talked to this Alan from ISC, who gave the tutorial on Sunday, told a little bit about the signing of the .pt. Top-level domain, so that's for Portugal. And one of the issues they had was that they had some secondary servers who ran such an old version of Bind that they didn't serve out certain DNSSEC records, and that broke stuff. Luckily, resolvers that do validation will try with a number of authoritative servers before they say, I can't trust this answer. but you really do want to check. Any people here using Red Hat Enterprise Linux on their systems? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There you go. Upgrade bind before you deploy DNSSEC, because the bind in Red Hat Enterprise is a fossil version. It's really, it is that old. And it doesn't serve out NSSEC 3 records, which are an important aspect of most DNSSEC deployments. Sorry?
Red Hat 6 came out today.
Really? Red Hat 6 came out? Okay. Upgrade to Red Hat 6.
And they backport our patch, some of our patches, to their Frankenstein version of Rocket. So it may or may not, even though they came out with a new version of the old OS, I can't guarantee that they've actually come out with a new version of Bind. So
check. You need at least Bind 9.6, but I would recommend Bind 9.7. So check. Of course, if you want to sign your zone, you can use not just OpenDNSSEC, but there is also Bind. Bind 9.7 is a lot better than Bind 9.6, so have a look at that. One of the problems with Bind, the current version, is that if you want to use something like an HSM, you need to have a patched OpenSSL version, which is a bit inconvenient, although I have heard today that there is work going on to fix that problem as well. And it doesn't do stuff like automated key rollover. It can help you, but it doesn't do the scheduling for you. You still need to work out the schedule yourself. Bind 10 is in the works, but that is an X-year project, a 3 or 5 year project. And the first alpha versions of that are out now, and that is going to be a lot better. That, just like OpenDNSSEC, that will help you automate stuff and make your life easier. So if you are a Bind shop, have a look at the work that's going on in Bind 10. Now, I mentioned PowerDNS, but nobody's using it, so I'll skip that anyway. There's also something called ZoneKey tool, which is basically something that works on top of Bind. That automates some of the signing processes for you, but that no longer seems to be maintained, so be careful before you start using that.
It actually is still maintained.
Okay.
And it is available in the Bind distribution.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Adam. Now, for those of you who feel that they would rather buy a box that does the job for them, that's also possible. There are commercial guys out there who made DNSSEC signers that you can just slot into your network that function like a bump in the wire, just like OpenDNSSEC does. Some of them are the Secure 64, Accelerance does a box. Especially the top one is very expensive. IPAM vendors, some of you here raised their hands when I asked about IPAM. The IPAM guys have been very avid about implementing DNSSEC in their solutions because of the .gov mandate. So most of the major IPAM vendors now support DNSSEC in their products. And of course, Microsoft has actually done something about DNSSEC. That has taken them some time. They've integrated DNSSEC support in Windows Server 2008 Release 2. Only not very user-friendly. It doesn't support NSSEC 3, and you need to do some pretty horrible command line stuff in order to get your zone signed. It doesn't integrate very well with Active Directory. So for the moment, I would say, like any first Microsoft release, steer around it and wait until they come up with the second version, which is probably going to be a lot better. Now, we need to talk about when things go wrong, because people make mistakes. And when things go wrong, you need to pick up, fix your mistake, or tell the people that made the mistake, because otherwise stuff like this will happen, right? No internet today. And you need to be open about it. The only way to get DNSSEC going on the internet has been so far to be generous, admit your mistakes, fix them, so that other people can learn from this experience. Fortunately, most of the people that have been doing DNSSEC so far have been quite open about it. So that has helped, and I'm going to be open about our deployment because we made a mistake. Don't know if you can see the little cartoon on the right. They are very popular in Holland. They're in a newspaper. Now, the bottom line of the little cartoon is that if you put garbage in, garbage comes out.
Oh, sorry.
And we signed surfnet.nl at the beginning of September on a Monday, and everything went just fine. We got nice signed zone out there, and everything was working, and it was all good. Until on a Thursday, one of my colleagues decided he needed to make a change to the zone. No problem, right? If you make a change, you just re-sign the zone, everything's peachy. Well, it turned out that there was a bug in a little component of OpenDNSSEC that does the DNS transfer. Remember the slide where I showed you our setup, which said SCP between the system which operates our hidden primary and the signer? The reason we put SCP there is because of this little bug. What happened is if a zone transfer got cut halfway through because of a problem, the zone transfer component in OpenDNSSEC just assumed that the transfer was successful. So what happened in this case is we had a nicely sorted zone, A to Z, going through the transfer process, and it stopped at the letter S. So we have Zimbra as an email system, which is a Z, so no more email for my colleagues. Dub, also after the letter S. Our VoIP server, V for VoIP. Oops. So we had a bit of a problem there. And I can tell you I didn't sleep very well that night. So what we had to do was we had to fix that. So we quickly found the bug, luckily, fixed it. So you can now rely on OpenDNSSEC as long as you use the latest release. But again, we learned from this, right? We tested everything. We tested transfers. We tested sign zones. But during our testing, this problem didn't come up. And only in real deployments do things start to go wrong. Now, luckily, I'm not the only one who makes mistakes. The people of the Czech and .us top-level registries, they decided they needed to do what is called an algorithm rollover. Basically, because they were early adopters, they were using some old algorithms in their DNSSEC setup, and they wanted to move to the new and more recent ones, and they made some mistakes. Which meant somewhere in June, no more Czech Republic, and somewhere in August, I think, no more .us, if you were validating, which we were. ISOC and .org, they nearly had a bit of a PR disaster. I was at the ICANN in Brussels to give a talk there about DNSSEC, and I was in a room full of people who had an interest in DNSSEC, and I usually highlight some of these problems in my presentations. And I'd had a look at our logs in the morning, and I'd seen that ISOC.org had validation failures, which was a bit of a surprise to me. So I sat there and told people about validation issues, and I said, well, since this morning, ISOC.org has validation problems, so they may want to have a look at that. And then two people in the room went white, ran out the room, and so when I'd finished my presentation, I walked up to a guy I knew and said, why did these guys run out? Well, ISOC are going to have a press conference in about an hour to tell the world that they have signed their domain and that they are the first people who use the regular process for the .org registry. So in the end, I ran out as well and helped them fix the problem because I knew what the issue was. But this stuff happens. The UK went offline, and the UK is a very popular domain in Holland. Many people query the BBC website for news, and I have a monitor alarm on our resolvers that triggers if the validation failure rate goes above 5%. Now that's very high, 5%, because normally the failed query rate will be 0.01%. So 5% is a very high threshold, and it had gone above that. So So I was on a train, I got a text message. So when I got home, I had looked it up. And I saw failed validation, news.bbc.co.uk. Oops. So I talked to the guys from the UK, and they had a glitch when they failed over from one signer to the other. Belgium forgot to update their signatures. Bye-bye, Belgium. Mozilla.org signed their domain. Very good, very commendable. The only thing they did is they made the secure delegation before they started serving the signed domain to the rest of the world, which meant that their domain went bogus, because the resolver saw that there is this secure delegation, so it knows Mozilla.org should be signed. But if it asks Mozilla.org, it doesn't get any DNSSEC signatures back. So obviously, you can't trust Mozilla.org. And Firefox goes to Mozilla.org every time you launch it to ask if there's a newer version of Firefox. So you can imagine what our logs look like when this happened. NASA did something a couple of weeks ago. They made the same mistake. They published a secure delegation before they served out the signed zone. So what does that look like for users? Well, here's a screenshot of Firefox with the DNSSEC plugin. And just like an SSL warning, it shows you that there is a DNSSEC issue with NASA.gov here. So this only happens if you have the DNSSEC plugin for Firefox. If you don't have that, like my Safari browser, this is a real screenshot. No faking here. You get this. Can't find the server. Doesn't exist. And I think this is better than the little pop-up warning that Firefox was showing. Why? Because people ignore these pop-ups. It's the same for SSL, right? I guess you're all, of course, good internet citizens, highly paranoid. If there is a certificate warning, you click no, right? You don't go to the website. Well, we did a little study among our constituency, which is mainly among the students. And we asked them, if you see this pop-up, what do you do? Well, we click yes, we want to ignore it. Of course, we want to go to the website. Even if it's your bank, yeah, of course, I need to check if I still have some money left to buy beer, right? So SSL pop-ups are bad news. And what DNSSEC does is, if the validation fails, you simply don't get an answer. And that is much more secure for end users. So rather than having all these plugins, I would really like to see this. And even better, people do their signing right. And one of the other things that we learned is that it is very hard to reach domain owners. I monitor our logging very regularly to check and see if validation failures occur. And I try to reach out to people who have a problem, right? Like NASA in this case, or like Mozilla. And I'm reasonably well connected. I can talk to some people in the ITF or people on the Internet Architecture Board and reach people. But if you email the email address that is in the SOA record for a zone, 100% of the people won't respond. Usually that email address doesn't even exist. So what my message to you would be is, if you sign your zone, make sure that something as simple as the email address in your SOA record actually ends up somewhere, so that if people contact you and want to tell you something important like, hey, you may have a mistake in your DNSSEC signing, that they can reach you. So that is, and also, a simple thing like an MX record, if there are validation failures, I can't send you email because the MX record is also in DNS. So I have a non-validating resolver to reach these people. So what have we learned? Well, DNSSEC is complex technology, but it is maturing, and actually it works quite well. As I said, the normal failed validation rate on our resolvers is 0.01% of all validations. So that's basically just a couple of people doing it wrong, and there are quite a few signed domains out there right now. The most important thing is, it is hard to reach zone owners. And that is only something that you can work on. As I said at the beginning of the presentation, we run a DNSSEC blog where we tell a little bit about the design decision that we made that I tried to illustrate in this presentation, but this goes into much more detail. So if you're interested, have a look at the blog and see if that is useful for you. It's actually quite popular in the US, funnily enough. There are other resources that you can have a look at. DNSSEC.net is a very good site that has many links out to other web resources that will help you get set up. We did a white paper 2 years ago about DNSSEC. It is a little bit outdated because it still talks about the root not being signed, but it explains very well how DNSSEC works, why you need it, so you can have a look at that. There is the DNSSEC Deployment Initiative, and of course the Public Internet Registry, the guys behind .org, have now launched a campaign called Practice Safe DNS, which has lots of internet gurus talking about DNSSEC. Now I'm coming to my conclusions here. The message is DNSSEC deployment has taken off. 2 years ago, before Kaminsky, nobody really had an interest in DNSSEC. Ever since then, people have been running very hard to get it going. And even though DNSSEC isn't perfect, actually it's quite hard to do, deployment has now taken off on a major scale. So the ball is now in your court. You, the sysadmin crowd, the second level domain owners are the people that now need to start considering DNSSEC. My first message would be that really you should try turning on validation on your resolver. The how-tos that I gave links to, will help you do that in 5 minutes. It is that easy. And it's the first start. You should think about signing, but you shouldn't run out the room and start signing all your major domains, even though Ellen wants you to do that. But think about what your deployment should look like. What is the value of your domains? What is the impact if it goes wrong? What are you protecting? But seriously consider it. And of course, admit mistakes if you make them. And the final message is, once it works, you don't really notice it's there. It's just plain old DNS and it does its job. And that's what we experienced. And that concludes my talk. If you have any questions, go ahead.
The most obvious question is, how do you protect your laptop?
Ah, that's a good question. Right. What I've been talking about is protecting the resolver by enabling DNSSEC validation, right? Well, there are two ways you can protect your laptop. The first one is simply use a validating resolver, because there really isn't a business case for attackers to use cache poisoning against something like your laptop. The business case is to attack the ISP resolver, which has hundreds of thousands of users. And if you really want to be sure, simply run a validating resolver on your laptop. Many people run resolvers on their end-user systems and forward queries to their ISP resolvers. Actually, Unbound has an installer that you can download, even for Windows. A simple double-click it, it will install a validating resolver, it will configure your system to use that resolver, and you're secured. It's that simple. Does that answer your question? Okay.
So one of the places, Garrett Wallman, MIT, one of the places where this seems like it's going to cause some problems is places like hotels that have captive portals that actually work by spoofing your DNS responses. And if you can't actually resolve them, then all of a sudden, well, you can't click through that page with the agreement that nobody ever reads.
Yeah. That's true. Captive portals are, from many perspectives, they're horrible things, but that is true. Captive portals will not work if you run a validating resolver on your end-user machine. And there's no simple way around that. The only thing you can do is disable validation if you are behind a captive portal and need to use that in order to use the internet. But you should be really wary of anything that interferes with your DNS. My advice would be, if you're on a captive portal, you're on unprotected Wi-Fi, which means that anyone can sniff your packets, right? So it's really bad technology anyway. But what I would advise you to do is maybe disable validation for a while, make sure you get logged in, and then quickly set up a VPN link to your office and run all your internet connectivity over that, which I'm sure many people do. At least I do that. The first thing I do is start up my VPN when I'm behind a captive portal. Does that answer your question? I have no solution for it. Alan.
Yeah, in addition to the problem with captive portals, I've been teaching classes out of hotel conference rooms and things along those lines for many years and doing a lot of things, a lot of traveling. And since my primary job is dealing with DNS, I've been doing DNSSEC validation for several years on my laptop. It isn't just the captive portal that you're going to run into problems with. It's going to be almost all DNS queries, because almost every hotel in existence these days grabs packets on port 53 and does nasty things to them.
Yeah.
They will respond with whatever they want you. They're acting as a man in the middle. And so even though you're doing resolution on your laptop, until you have that VPN where you're able to not let them diddle with your packets, port 53 is an open target. And so really running validation on anything that is not cleanly out to the internet is a waste of time. Yeah. Hotels, airports, coffee shops.
Yeah.
Unless you're VPNing, don't even try to do validation because it will fail.
No, because they will just use any if there's a query failure or whatever, they will seize that opportunity to redirect you and show you some advertisements. That's basically what most of them do. So, any other questions?
Standing back up to speak about something else. So I just want to say we started, and we've been running DNSSEC for about 3 years now, actually. Last September, when I finally got the news about, oh, wow, they signed the root and it actually works. So I actually installed that key in all of our resolvers. And the only problem that anyone has actually noticed so far was when the Belgians forgot to re-sign their keys.
Okay, so that's good. That's our experience as well. There are some people that make mistakes, but they get fixed and they're intermittent and they go away. And actually the majority of queries just work very well. As I said, zero help desk calls. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And go and enjoy the happy hour.